Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we'll revisit our conversation from March of 2018 with Elaine Weiss, author of The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. It's Nashville, August 1920. 35 states have ratified the 19th Amendment. 12 have rejected or refused to vote. One last state is needed. It all comes down to Tennessee, the moment of truth for suffragists after a seven-decade crusade. The opposing forces include politicians with careers at stake, liquor companies, railroad magnates, and racists who don't want black women voting. And then there are the antis, women who oppose their own enfranchisement, fearing suffrage will bring about the moral collapse of the nation. They all converge in a boiling hot summer for a face-off replete with dirty tricks, betrayals and bribes, bigotry, Jack Daniels, and the Bible. Elaine Weiss is an award-winning journalist and writer whose work has appeared in The Atlantic, Harper's, The New York Times, Christian Science Monitor, as well as in reports and documentaries for National Public Radio and The Voice of America. A McDowell Colony Fellow and Pushcart Prize Editor's Choice honoree, she's also author of Fruits of Victory, The Woman's Land Army and the Great War. She lives in Baltimore. So Nashville, summer of 1920, 35 states have ratified the 19th Amendment. 12 have rejected or refused to vote. It comes down to Tennessee. If Tennessee ratifies it, it's ratified. If they don't, then the 19th Amendment might be dead.
Yeah, it really is that stark. This becomes the last best hope for the suffragists because the other southern states, for the most part, have rejected the amendment. There are two northern states where the governors are refusing to call a special session of their legislature to consider it. They're under all kinds of political pressures. There's one southern state, Florida, which is also refusing. So it really is coming down to Tennessee. And if not, there are movements afoot to recall some of the ratifications. There's a strong anti-suffrage lobby which is working to undermine what has already been accomplished. And so the suffragists realize that if they lose in Tennessee, it's not only will stop any momentum they have, but it really may be spell the end for the near future of the amendment. And the 1920 presidential election is coming up, and it's a very important election where the direction of the country is going to be decided, and women need to have a voice. And so they realize this is the Alamo, this is the last stand, but so do the anti-suffragists. And so that's what sets up this incredible confrontation in Tennessee. It's not just that it's just another ratification. It may be the last, or it may not. And everyone knows the stakes, and the stakes are extremely high. And the forces that gather there are very well aware that if either side loses, that's the end for them. Now, the suffragists probably would have kept on going and perhaps been able to make some headway, but they can see that the pendulum of public opinion and the tenor of the nation is turning more conservative, and that does happen. So they're afraid if they don't get it now, it's just not going to happen in perhaps in their lifetimes. So it's a very crucial time, and it becomes so dramatic because the stakes are so high. They're throwing everything at it. They pull out all the stops, and so do the anti-suffragists. So there's fist fights and bribery and drunkenness and betrayal and singular acts of courage, and that makes for a great tale. And I think that's what I try to tell in the book.
Yeah, it reads like a novel, right? It's history. I want to get into, have you tell me about some of the leaders of the various movements. But before I do that, I think we forget the 1920s, and you have pointed this out, there's a lot of parallels from the 1920s to today, including the fact that the campaign slogan for the leading candidate for president was America First.
Oh, yes. Yes, it was. Yes, there are parallels. There's parallels in what worries the nation. And I think I was struck by this. In 1920, there's a lot of concern about immigration. immigration has transformed America. There's been a great wave of immigrants, which is, of course, what will make America great in the 20th and 21st centuries. And sometimes we forget that. But there was anxiety about all these foreign immigrants coming in and making a home here. And it strengthened us, but it frightened us. So you have immigration being debated. You have labor insecurity. Industries are afraid of automation. We're still talking about that. And there's a question of where organized labor comes in. That's being causing anxiety. There's, of course, racial tensions. There are race riots throughout the country, starting in 1917, continuing right up to the minute in 1920, because there are racial tensions going on. There's economic insecurities. There's all these ideas that we're grappling with now that were also being discussed in 1920, including the role of America in the world. We just come out of what they would call then the Great War. We call it World War I. And what is America's role? Is it to be a leader of the free world? Or is it to withdraw and become a nationalist nation that isn't really involved in world affairs? And that's a real decision point being debated in the 1920 election. And Warren Harding, the Republican candidate, is saying America first and does not want us to join the League of Nations. And the Democratic candidate, James Cox of Ohio, is saying, no, we must join. We must be a leader in the free world. And that's a big part of the debate. And it has an impact on what's going on in Tennessee, because this is going to expand the electorate. It's going to double the electorate. And that's a big, unpredictable vote. And so the politicians are worried about it. There are corporations that are worried about it because they feel their business interests are at stake. So another theme that comes through that we're dealing with now is corporate influence in politics and dark money flowing into campaigns. That's something that's a big element of what my book is about. And here you see we're talking about it and arguing about it today. So it was both amazing to me and sobering to realize that these issues that are so prominent in 1920 and make the action of the book so compelling are not resolved. We're still debating them.
I want to talk about the arguments on either side, maybe starting with the anti-side, because I think it's maybe less understandable today. It's a fait accompli that the women have the vote. And I think most today would agree that's, should be, democracy expanded, hopefully. I was interested, maybe I'll ask you this, in the reading guide for the book, there was a provocative question. If the vote were held today, ratification vote, and if only men had the vote on whether or not to allow the 19th Amendment, would it pass? I thought that was an interesting question.
Yes, I think it is. And I think it's thought-provoking, considering the kind of discourse we've had in the last 18 months. And remember, in this whole suffrage movement, it's only men who are able to decide whether women are entitled to full citizenship, to equal rights. It's only men who can decide either at the state level in referenda on women's suffrage or in the state legislatures or in Congress and then back to the state legislatures for ratification. It's only men who are deciding. And so we have to think, if we were back in that situation and asking men to basically dilute their political power by half, if you want to be really, blunt about what they're being asked to do, if they believe that women are their equals as citizens and as people, what would happen now? Consider what is, what we see in our headlines, on our radios, on our Twitter feeds, and think about that. And I think that's a kind of interesting and unnerving question, but something we should grapple with, because we still are not sure, I don't believe, we're not secure about our democracy. What does it mean to be a democratic republic if we put barriers before people, our citizens, can vote, and whether that's women or black people or Hispanic people or immigrants? What does it mean if we do not encourage everyone to vote? And I think that's a question we should still be grappling with.
You're listening to Access Utah. We're talking with Elaine Weiss, talking about her book from 2018 called The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. We'll have much more as the hour goes along following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're visiting our conversation from 2018 with Elaine Weiss, author of The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. We're looking at the great culmination of the fight for women's suffrage in the United States, the summer of 1920 in Nashville, as Tennessee prepares for a crucial vote. By the way, Elaine Weiss is author of a new book just out this year. It's called Spell Freedom, The Underground Schools That Built the Civil Rights Movement. Here's back to our conversation about the Woman's Hour. I want to talk about some of the arguments against the 19th Amendment. I'm looking at, this is, I think, the illustration that most stood out to me in the whole book. It's a, I don't know, it's a flyer, a broadside, America when feminized, it says, and it
yes.
shows a rooster and a hen. The rooster has to, you know, the hen is leaving, I guess, to go vote, and the rooster has to take care of the eggs. I want to read just a paragraph from this. Woman suffrage denatures both men and women. It masculinizes women, feminizes men. The history of ancient civilization has proven that a weakening of the man power of nations has been but a pre-runner of decadence in civilization. Then they quote an expert, Dr. William J. Hickson, Chicago University. The effect of social revolution on American character will be to make sissies of American men, process already well underway, says Dr. Hickson.
Yes. And then there's the kicker line there. I'm not sure if you read that. A vote for the federal amendment is a vote for organized female nagging forever.
That's right. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
I think we see the theme of insecurity being expressed there. But what you have to understand is this broadside was actually published by women. It was published by women who opposed suffrage, which gives it a whole nother cast. Because they are saying that it will destroy the American home and destroy the American society if women are given the right to vote. They really fear that this is a precursor to women leaving their families, abandoning them to, you know, go out into the public sphere. Maybe they'll want to work outside the home. That's a fear. Maybe they're going to feel they should have an equal partnership in their marriage. That's a fear. That's what you see being expressed there. You know, the idea that the rooster may have to sit on the eggs, may have to take care of children. It's all these elements of our domestic and social life that we're still grappling with. You know, I have a family. I know these things aren't resolved, but there's a real fear among those opposed to suffrage, that this is an unnatural upending of both social mores and home life, that this is not just a political decision. This is going to affect the American home. It's going to destabilize man in his castle if women are giving this vote. And there are other broadsides that the anti-suffragists publish that show a pair of pants and say, who's going to wear these in your family once women get to vote? So you do see these themes, and again, I would venture to say these have not been resolved in even our modern society, but you see them expressed in these ways that kind of take your breath away by the anti-suffragists. And so these are both men and women who feel that this will cause a cultural and social upheaval. Then there are religious conservatives, both men and women, who believe this is goes against God's plan, that God made Adam to dominate Eve, and that's her proper role, to be subservient, and anything else is, it goes against biblical teachings. That's used as a rationale against suffrage. And then you have other arguments and other actors who are coming in, either political or corporate interests, who are also attacking suffrage. But for the women anti-suffragists, it's mostly either a religious or a ideological opposition to women becoming the political equals of men. And they see this as a dangerous, slippery slope.
It's interesting to see, I remember some of these same arguments in the 1970s, Equal Rights Amendment, which did fail.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It did fail. And one of the interesting things is you will meet in the Woman's Hour several of the characters who then, just 3 years later, draft and get introduced into Congress the Equal Rights Amendment. It is formulated by Alice Paul and Sue Sheldon White, who plays a strong character in this book. And they say, well, once we have the vote, that's the first thing. Now we need equal rights, and we need it in political realms and social realms. And they draft and have introduced into the Congress in 1923 the Equal Rights Amendment. And it has been now 95 years, and it has not been passed. It was passed by Congress. It was not ratified. So we see that it's possible for something to be in limbo for a long, long time. And I agree. I remember those arguments, too, and arguments about how this was, women's liberation, which was the way it was expressed in the 1970s, was going to destroy the American home. So, yeah, these arguments have legs, so to speak. And we see, we see echoes of it today, absolutely. That's both frightening and makes us want to understand where this comes from. And I think the Woman's Hour helps us understand where this comes from.
Yes.
Because there is a continuum in this argument. But I don't want your listeners to think this is a kind of dry political tome, because it really isn't, and I didn't write it like that. It's really kind of a political thriller, as I like to call it. It's fast-paced, and it's has these great, colorful characters, kind of larger-than-life characters, both women and men, who are battling it out for the sake of justice. So it's this very compelling front story of what happens in Tennessee, but through that you see all these themes of American history coursing through it.
Yeah, I want to get into some of the colorful characters, and there are many in this book. One more maybe overarching theme. You write in your introduction, as this is an American story, it is inevitably about race, which I think is a good line. The anti-suffragist movement was using states' rights, right? We can't allow federal government or the Constitution to abrogate the states' right to decide who gets to vote. And behind that, I suppose, we don't want black women to vote.
Precisely. That is absolutely the rationale of many of the anti-suffragists, especially in the South, and especially in this last battle in a southern state. It's not subtle. They say it blatantly, that this is a threat. Having women vote, which would include black women, ability to vote, has the potential to destroy white supremacy. And it's kind of shocking to see that said right out loud. But then you realize that same argument will be used throughout the 20th century. It'll be used again to fight federal mandates for voting rights. It'll be used to fight integration. And that states' rights argument is being used today to restrict voting in some states. It's being used continuously. And so that's when I say race is a a sort of motif that runs through all of American history, it becomes very apparent that this fight about women's suffrage, you don't think of it in racial terms, but it's very much a racial issue. And one of the other parts of the argument is that when it comes down to it, there are white suffragists, not all, but some, who are willing to barter away the rights of black women to vote. And one of the heartbreaking things that I realize after the vote is won is that, for the most part, white suffragists, satisfied they have the vote, are not going to fight for their black sisters who have fought with them to demand the vote, and then are left behind as, especially in the southern states, they're disenfranchised just as the black men have been.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that's very cautionary, when we realize in their moment of victory, the suffragists are not going to fight for the next 50 years to help their black sisters gain equality. And again, it's a lesson for us. It's a cautionary tale. You have to bring everybody in. It's not a democracy if you don't.
I want to have you tell me about some of the fascinating figures. Maybe if you'd start with Carrie Catt.
Yeah, so I try to tell the story through the eyes of three of the major protagonists. And one is the woman who's the head of the largest national American Women's Suffrage Association. It claims 2 million members. Her name is Carrie Chapman Catt, and she's a fascinating character. She grows up as a farm girl in Iowa and experiences the idea that she is not going to be able to vote and her mother is not able to vote. And she begins to question it as a young girl and says, well, this doesn't seem right. And she devotes her life to changing that. And she becomes a protege of Susan B. Anthony, who grooms her for leadership very carefully. And that's one of the interesting things about how this movement carefully cultivates the next generation of leaders. I think that's something we've lost, that very deliberate and careful cultivation of a next generation. And so she takes on the reins of the suffrage movement when Susan B. Anthony leaves. And even though she comes in and out of the official presidency, she really is seen as both a national leader and an international leader. She's head of the International Women's Suffrage Association. And that reminds us that this is not just happening in America. It's happening around the world at that time. And some countries have given the vote to women by 1920. There's something like 26 nations ahead of us who have decided to give their women the right to vote. And so Carrie Catt is, she's called the chief. She's a master tactician and strategist and politician. She's probably one of the most famous women in America in 1920. She's on the covers of magazines and newspapers. And she is summoned to lead the battle in Nashville. And she comes to Nashville kind of reluctantly. She's bothered by the heat. She's kept in what's essentially house arrest in the hotel because they feel that she'll be too controversial to be seen on the streets of Nashville. This Yankee woman coming to lead the suffragists, so they keep her in her room. And then there's another young woman who comes to Nashville to lead her wing of the suffrage movement, which is the Alice Paul National Women's Party. This is the more radical, I don't call it militant because they really were not militant, but they were radical, and they were impatient. They were the younger generation. They're saying, we've waited much too long for this. We've been too polite. We're not willing to beg for the vote anymore. We're going to demand it. And so they start off on these major marches through Washington, marches through the streets of cities all over the nation. They picket the White House, which had never been done before by anybody. They burn President Wilson in effigy outside the gates of the White House. They go to prison, and Sue White does go to prison. She goes to prison for her civil disobedience, for protesting the lack of her civil rights. She has to serve her time. And then she is summoned to Nashville also and arrives to lead this younger, more radical faction And she has to confront her mentors, the older women who have kind of brought her up in the suffrage movement. And it's a very emotional and complex psychological moment for her. She's testing herself as a leader, and she's also having you see the split in the movement, which happens in many social and political movements, and suffragists are split, and they're working separately towards the same goal. And so you see that embodied in these women. It's not just an abstract concept. These women are having to make separate paths, and they have separate headquarters. And then the third woman who arrives on that same night in Nashville to take command is a woman named Josephine Pearson, who's a very well-educated college administrator from the mountains of southern Tennessee, and she comes to fight against suffrage. She's head of the Tennessee Anti-Suffrage Women, and she believes this is going to be the downfall of America if she is if the amendment is ratified. And so she is there to lead the anti-suffragists, and they all arrive in Nashville on the same night, and they stay at the same hotel. And you sort of see all the strains and strands of this argument and this crusade crystallizing as these women arrive in Nashville. And then they're going to be joined by several thousand other people who come in to witness and to participate in this grand finale, this climax of this seven-decade movement.
It's pressure cooker, right? Hot summer pressure cooker, because I think everybody knows on all sides, this is it.
Absolutely. It's like the Alamo. You know, they really do know it. And that sense of it being the last stand both animates them and frightens everyone. And it means they pull out all the stops. And they are going to do things that perhaps are not wise, but they know this is it, and the anxiety of the suffragists go through as, frankly, they see what they thought was possible, that possibility erode as they see the votes melting away under the pressure of bribery and political pressure and all kinds of other influences that are making those legislators who said, oh, sure, I'll vote for ratification, suddenly have second thoughts. And so during the course of the 6 weeks, you see them betrayed. You see them having to scramble to find a new strategy. You see them championed by unlikely men. And so there's this very emotional roller coaster that I try to take the reader on, which mirrors the roller coaster that the suffragists are on, and the anti-suffragists, because for them it's possibly the end too. So it's very emotional. It's very it's political theater, because you have all these actors. You have male politicians. You have male journalists and newspaper publishers who are part of this fight. You have the presidential candidates. You have their political parties. You have the president in the White House who is an invalid, and is trying to have this last modicum of power, and is trying to protect his own legacy. And you have all these different forces who you would think have nothing to do with women's suffrage, but they have everything to do with it. And that's what makes it such a compelling and complex story. And as you say, it's a pressure cooker. They're under the pressure of intense heat. There's no air conditioning. They're also under the pressure of drunken legislators who are being plied with liquor by the liquor industry in a room in the hotel, which is kind of a speakeasy and is called the Jack Daniel's Suite. And they're trying to convince legislators not to kill the amendment, because the liquor industry is afraid that women will insist on enforcement of the new prohibition laws, and they're hoping it won't be enforced. So they have a lot at stake in opposing the amendment also. And so you have these drunken legislators running through the corridors, singing at the top of their lungs, and the poor suffragists kind of cowering in their rooms. You have spies going to listen through the transoms. What's happening? You have kidnappings. You have fistfights. you have all the elements of a great political and almost comical battle going on within this hotel and within the city. And it's all in the service of this very important Civil Rights Act. So it's one of those stories that can read like a novel, and I hope it does, but it has all these levels of meaning and importance in our history that I hope will come through to the reader.
And we'll preserve, you know, some of the surprise. Let me just say, I don't think this ruins too much. This is in the publicity materials. At the last moment, a decisive vote of conscience. So we will leave that to the readers.
Yes.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and we're talking with Elaine Weiss about her book, a fascinating book, called The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We are going back to March of 2018, revisiting our conversation with Elaine Weiss, talking about her book, The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote.
I want to read another question from the reader's guide. This is kind of some nice questions here. I guess if you've got a reading group or just reading the book, you can find this at penguinrandomhouse.com. And by the way, Elaine Weiss's website, elaineweiss.com, and some great stuff on both sites. So the suffragists, I'm reading from Penguin Random House, suffragists touted the benefits of allowing women to vote. They maintained that women could would clean up corruption in politics, insist upon better laws protecting families and children. Carrie Catt even believed that women voters would bring about an end to war. I guess that was one, you know, there's the moral argument, there's the democracy argument that, hey, half our country can't vote, and if we're going to call ourselves a democracy. But these are interesting arguments that women would have a moderating, a moral influence if they could
vote.
Yes,
that is used.
Mm-hmm. I wonder... So the reading guide goes on. Let me pose this to you. Do you think women voters have improved our political system?
That's a really good question. I think the empirical evidence is not really. And I think Carrie Catt was very disappointed in some ways that women did not seem to serve this role. And she may have been very naive and... thinking that women would fundamentally vote differently than men. And for a long time, they did not. There is some evidence that they do now, but not completely. And certainly the 2016 election taught us that's not completely true. So whether they brought greater moral insights, hard to say. They certainly did not clean up corruption in government, and they certainly have not put an end to war. So I think some of the aspirations of the suffragists in and some of the arguments they used turned out to not be true and to be kind of faulty and perhaps not founded in fact. And that's, you know, that's an interesting part. They were prophesizing what women could do. They were hoping or they were assuming. That moral argument had a flip side, though. The anti-suffragists also used that moral argument, and they were saying that women are too delicate. Their moral sensibilities are so finely tuned that they would be corrupted and sullied if they were allowed to vote, to enter the political conversation, that this would actually endanger women because they are so morally superior. So they were using the other end of that argument to say women shouldn't have the vote. They really believe that it would sully women. Another aspect of this is women were not allowed to serve on juries. That was seen as only given to those who had the vote. And another argument against used by the anti-suffragists was you don't want women to be able to serve on a jury and hear all these horrible things that happen in a criminal case. And the suffragists are saying, hell yeah, we want to be on a jury. We want to have a jury of our peers. When we stand trial, if a woman is accused of a crime, she never has a woman on the jury. And she cannot serve on a jury. She could not testify in court. So all these rights that we take so much for granted are still up in the air, and they're being used by both sides to argue their case.
Of course, as we mentioned before, sometimes we forget this was a 70-year struggle in the United States, ultimately successful, and there was a price to be paid, right? Physical attack, imprisonment, force feeding, ostracization. Bringing it forward to today, what lessons do you think activists today can learn from, I guess, both sides of this long struggle?
Absolutely. And I think we forget how brave these women had to be to stand up, because at the time in the 19th century, when it begins, women are not supposed to even speak in public. And they're denounced and shouted down. They're pelted with rotten eggs and vegetables. Bombs are thrown into their meetings. They're vilified as being perverts, as being too masculine. They're made fun of. They're thrown out of their clubs. They're thrown out of their churches for demanding the vote. So we kind of take it for granted that, oh, yeah, well, they just stood up and demanded this. Well, it took a lot of fortitude and a thick skin to do that. So that's the first thing, that taking a stand often, you take risks. It's always taking a risk. I think another lesson is that political change is hard and social change is slow, and both of those are necessary. Women's suffrage wasn't just a political issue. It was a social and a moral and a cultural debate about women's role in society. And so it had all the complications of what we call the culture wars today. And so I think activists can look at the example of this seven-decade crusade to win equal political rights for women and say, wow, it took a long time. It did not happen overnight. First, they had to change hearts and minds and blast through stereotypes and gender assumptions. And then they had to bring it into the legal realm. And they had to stand up and be brave, and they had to be, most of all, persistent. They had to keep going through enormous frustration and obstacles and setbacks and schisms and splits within their own movement. They had to finance it themselves. They had to convince men that they had a right to demand their own freedom. And all of those issues still face activists. And I think what I hope this will teach, the story of the Women's Hour, will teach activists, for whatever cause, not just women, but all groups and individuals who are fighting for a more just society, that change takes time, it takes persistence, but it also takes organization. It doesn't take just protest. You also have to have very sophisticated and strong and resilient political strategy behind you. You have to be working with lots of coalitions, and you have to be working at different levels of government to lobby, to campaign, and finally to convince a change in law. And that's hard, and that's complicated, but we have a nice blueprint of how it can be done.
How would you, or maybe just your thoughts, connecting this history to the current Me Too movement?
Well, it's interesting. As I've watched this unfold, I realize that for quite a few of the characters who I profile and are my characters in the book, they come to the idea of women, that they as women are not equal, that they face great barriers of inequality through a personal experience. And I found that interesting because, you see, in these current Me Too movements, it's a personal experience that galvanizes a political statement or political reaction. And so for Carrie Catt, it happens when she's a young girl, and it's election day, and her mother, who's very politically aware and astute and reads all the newspapers and debates at the family table about who should be the best candidate, and she stays home as the men go off to vote, and young Carrie says, wait a second, why aren't you going to vote? And her father and the men folk and the hired hands who can't read themselves say, oh, no, this is much too important a decision to leave for women to have a voice. And that just incensed her. And then as a young working widow, she experiences sexual harassment on her job. And she realizes women need protection. They need the vote to protect them. And this animates her and energizes her, and she dedicates her life to changing those laws. Same thing happens to Elizabeth Cady Stanton and to Susan Anthony and to any number. Sue White, the younger suffrage worker in Tennessee, is told she wants to be a lawyer, and she's told, no, women can't do that. They're not smart enough, and we don't allow them to become lawyers. And it bothers them on a personal level, and that then becomes the groundwork for their political stance. And so I think that's an interesting way of looking at it, that the women who are standing up and saying, we can't be treated like this. There's something in our culture, there's something in the structure of our companies and of our society that's allowing this, and it has to stop, and we have to figure out how to stop it, that it comes from the personal becomes the political. And I think that's an interesting model for us to look at. And that's what I saw as I've seen this movement unfold.
There's a very poignant caption in the book. It's Susan B. Anthony's grave, festooned with I voted stickers. The caption says, on Election Day 2016, thousands of American women visited the graves of suffrage movement leaders, honoring their legacy by pasting I voted stickers on their headstones, honoring the pioneers of the movement in that way.
Absolutely. I mean, it was an extraordinary moment for me. I had no idea this was going to happen. I had just handed in the manuscript the day before, and it's Election Day, and I see these news flashes that thousands of women, it's not just a few, thousands, and men, but mostly women, are going to vote. Many of them voting for a woman candidate, but not all, and then going to the grave sites of the suffragists who gave that vote to them. And so we know, that it probably happened even on a broader level, but we do know that women went to the cemetery in New York City where Carrie Catt and Elizabeth Cady Stanton are buried. They went to Alice Paul's gravesite in New Jersey. In Rochester, New York, more than 10,000 women and men and children, and I've seen video footage of this, more than 10,000 went to visit her grave, and that's the photo in the book. They put their I voted stickers, they put thank you cards, they put flowers there, and they were thanking the women who fought all their lives to give modern women the vote, a voice in their own government. And it was very poignant. And, of course, it becomes even more poignant when you realize that some of their aspirations for that election were not going to be realized. But it doesn't take away from the idea that this kind of sacrifice, which I detail in the book and which comes to a crashing climax in those 6 weeks in Tennessee, are being remembered today. That importance of that fight is still very resonant, and I think can teach us so much about not only where we came from, but where we need to go.
Finally, Ed, I want to have you talk a little bit about one of the dedications of the book. In memory of my parents, you say, who took their little girl into the voting booth, let her pull the magic curtain, and taught me to treasure my right to vote.
Yeah, that's a heartfelt dedication, because my parents did do that, and I think a lot of children have that memory of taking me into the voting booth with them, and it was the old-fashioned kind, with the big lever that would open and close the curtain and would also register your vote, and there would be the levers. It wasn't these touchscreen things. It was much more tactile, and they would take me in, and they would push the levers that they wanted for the candidates and for the whatever referendum was on the ballot, and then they'd let me, with a little bit of assistance, because I think it was too heavy for me to do alone, they'd let me pull that lever, and it would open up the curtains in very dramatic fashion. And this, to me, was the sense of both theater and importance. This was, you know, the right of citizenship. And it was what I did not question at the time was that, gosh, you know, two generations before, I couldn't have voted. My mother couldn't have voted. How did this happen? How I never thought that my vote was controversial, that my ability as a young, even as a girl, that my mother's vote was controversial, that my vote had once been controversial. And so when I realized that that's the beginning of my consciousness about voting, and it never occurred to me that this could ever be controversial. And then we see in 1920, which is around the time my parents were born, how controversial it was. And that was really startling to me. And then when my children were young, my husband and I took them into the voting booth. Of course, the voting machines had changed a little bit, and the curtains are not quite as dramatic. But it was that sense that citizenship is precious, and it has to be the idea of a vote is precious, and we have to protect it. And today our job is to protect the vote for all citizens, not just women, all citizens.
Well, we're out of time. A fascinating book. It's a pulse pounder, and it's a history that a lot of us don't know. It's that final push to win the vote, to the passage of the 19th Amendment. The title is The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. The author is Elaine Weiss, and it's out now, well worth the read. And the website is elaineweiss.com. Elaine Weiss, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. A great pleasure to be with you.
Thanks for listening today, and just a note that Elaine Weiss has a new book out just this year. It's called Spell Freedom, The Underground Schools That Built the Civil Rights Movement. Thanks for listening today.
It's one sky, many cultures. Skywatcher Leo T here. With summer here, Scorpius awaits you as the night grows late. The moon prepares to molt from old to new and greet Mercury in the twilight. And these evenings look south-southeast to south for glowing orange Antares, a first-magnitude red supergiant. Around and upper right of Antares are other whiter stars of upper Scorpius. Get out the binoculars, you can see some pretty cool stuff up there. It's forming their familiar distinctive pattern. And with a small telescope, make out a Beta Scorpii, a unique double star. Looks like a proton and a neutron right on top of each other. The rest of the Scorpion runs down from Antares, then left, then up to the tail with its cat's eyes. Left of here is the teapot of Sagittarius with all its glowing nebulosity and novus. The farther north you are, the lower they will appear. This is the time of the year when, at the end of twilight, the Little Dipper floats straight upward from the North Pole Polaris, perhaps like a helium balloon escaped up into the night from some June evening party. And as we talk about stars and suns, our own life-giving sun star has been putting on quite a show for the last few months. Actually, the last few years, with solar flares and prominences sending plasma our way and fueling life on Earth and giving us some nice lights to look at night. The solar probe has been out in the solar system getting closer to the sun than any Earth spaceship ever and getting a gravity boost out of Venus to get even more momentum and come back even closer to dip into the sun's corona, and just made an amazing close flyby starting on June 19th, coming within 3.8 million miles and traveling at an amazing 430,000 miles an hour. Yeah, Superman can't do that. Barker's observations of the solar wind and solar events such as flares and coronal mass ejections are critical to advancing humankind's understanding of the sun and the phenomena that drive high-energy space weather. And this note on JPL's Psyche heavy metal asteroid probe, you may remember it if you listen to the Skywatcher Leo T episodes. Its main thrusters had a glitch a while back, and I'm happy to report to you that the operations crew has the backup xenon science fiction thrusters ready to go for its flyby of Mars and into the asteroid belt of the first heavy metal asteroid scientists have found. It is one sky, many cultures, and let's take a little trip around the globe to the Middle East and check in on Iranian mythology, or Persian mythology. Is the body of myths originally told by ancient Persians and other Iranian peoples and a genre of ancient Persian folklore. These stories concern the origin and nature of the world, the lives and activities of deities, heroes, and mythological creatures, and the origins and significance of the ancient Persians' myths to shed light on not only Iran, but of the Persosphere, which includes regions of West Asia, Central Asia, South Asia, and Transcaucasia, where the culture of Iran has had significant influence. Star Wars, one of these stories perhaps influenced by stargazing Babylonian astronomers. The ancient Iranians associated some of their deities with the stars. The star Sirius represented the rain god Tishtraya, whose main role was to battle Apasha, an evil star of drought. Tishkyra, in the form of a white stallion, and Apasha, a hideous black horse, fought for 3 days. Then, with Ahura Mazda's help, Tishtyra defeated Apasha. Tishtyra and other star gods who protected agriculture also took charge of battling meteors, or shooting stars, which some Persians believed to be witches. Iranian festivals include Nowruz, which means a new day, and it is the celebration of the start of spring, rejuvenation. It starts on the first day of spring, also the first day of the Iranian calendar year, March 21st. In that 12 days, as a sign of the past 12 months, all Iranian families gather around to visit each other. So meditate for peace as we look up, look around, and get just a little bit lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T.